Chapter 48. Last time Mab had taken this walk, it had been with Francis. "We'll bring Lucy," she'd thought at the time, head against his shoulder as they looked out at the lake. She let herself sink into that dream now, Francis pointing out the flowers she couldn't identify, Lucy running after butterflies, Mab following in a summer straw hat. Francis would have carried Lucy over the steep bits of the climb. Lucy would have allowed that. At the very end in Coventry, she'd let him pick her up. She'd been learning to trust him. She would have let him carry her all the way to the top of the lookout here. Only now she never would. Why? The word had been echoing through Mab's brain for 3 weeks now, about everything. Why? 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 Why didn't you marry him at once, instead of waiting until you were sure he was a good prospect? Why didn't you quit working at Bletchley Park and make a home right away for him and Lucy? Why were you so careful not to conceive a child? Why and if, the two most painful words in existence. If she'd married Francis Gray the week he proposed, they'd have had 3 more months of married life. If she'd resigned from BP, she would have had her family together every night when Lucy came home from school and Francis came home from work, not spread out and waiting because war work had somehow seemed more important. If she hadn't been so careful to avoid conception, she might have had something of Francis beside a packet of love letters. "You have more than that," she reminded herself bitterly. "You have everything you ever dreamed of, Mab Gray." She'd wanted to ditch the name Chert and remake herself as a lady of means, with no whiff of scandal that she'd ever been a cheap East End slut who gave birth out of wedlock. Well, she was Mrs. Gray now, and she was certainly a lady of means. Francis's will named her sole inheritor of his modest royalties and not-so-modest accounts. She could afford all the fine hats and leather-bound books she wanted, and no one would ever know she'd given birth out of wedlock because her child was dead. She realized that she was ripping her blue-ribboned hat to pieces and flinging them off the lookout. The ribbon went drifting down the hillside, as blue as the surface of Derwent Water, then the straw brim, then the wafty netting. In Francis's wallet, returned to her with his effects, she'd found a folded sheet of paper with a few scribbled lines in his writing. "The Girl with the Hat, a sonnet by Francis Gray. The mirror shows a fairy queen in red, posing, turning, angling with a smile. She tilts a straw-made hat upon her head. Christ, this is awful stuff, Gray. Whoever said you could write poetry?" But there were more lines, reworked and crossed out and reworked again. And at the very bottom he'd squeezed in a note. "Work Lucy into the metaphor. Titania's sprite, peas blossom. Or is Luce more of a mustard seed?" The pain clawed Mab like some hungry beast, doubling her over. It never hit when she expected it to. She'd stood entirely numb through Lucy's funeral in London, through Francis's here. Sometimes it crept up on her at night, leaving her sobbing. Or it overcame her when she was pouring a brandy and wondering if she'd sleep if she drank an entire bottle. She never knew when it was coming, only that it would never stop. She was 24 years old, she'd been a mother for 6 years, and a wife for less than one, and the pain was never going to stop. Then she turned and saw Osler and Beth coming up the path onto the lookout. Mab didn't wait for either of them to speak. She pulled her head back and spat at Osler, hitting Osler's black cashmere coat hem. "How dare you show up at his funeral, Osler Kendall? How dare you?"
"I came for you," Osler whispered. "I'm your friend."
"You killed them," Mab rasped. "You let go of Lucy. You let her go, and Francis went tearing off after her."
"Yes."
Osler stood chalk white and shaking, but she didn't flinch from the accusation.
"It's my fault.
All you had to do was hold on to her, and you let her go." Mab had her voice scaling up and choked it off. She would kill Osler and Beth right here and now if she cried in front of them. If we'd got to a damned air raid shelter."
"You can't blame Osler," Beth whispered.
"Yes, I can."
Mab felt herself smiling mirthlessly. The smile hurt. She welcomed the pain, dug into it, ate it raw and sopping red.
"I can blame everyone.
The Luftwaffe for bombing Coventry, herself for insisting Francis take them there. Francis for stepping left instead of right to get out of the garden.
But all Osla had to do was hang on to Lucy's hand, and she fucking let her go.
I did. Osla's eyes overflowed, tears streaking sooty and black down her cheeks.
She was my daughter,
Mab whispered.
You killed my daughter.
She was your sis? Beth began automatically, literal as ever. And then even Beth stopped dead, her eyes huge and horrified. Osla trembled.
Oh, Mab.
Shut up.
Mab was shaking too now.
Don't you say a goddamned word to me ever again, Osla Kendall. Don't you dare.
Chapter 49. The tiny lake at Bletchley Park sometimes froze thick enough in wintertime for skating. Some off-duty codebreakers were playing hockey today, bashing sticks around the ice. But Beth ignored them. She stood on the bank, looking at the beaten steel sky, thinking of Coventry, Francis and Lucy, Mab's daughter, Osla and Mab.
I can't tell them, Beth thought, breathing raggedly. Not ever.
Couldn't tell them how all hell had broken loose in ISK, tearing Beth away from the message she'd been decrypting about the Coventry raid. Someone shouting about Allied forces in North Africa. Suddenly everyone had been gathering around the radio, breathless with excitement. It was the kind of turnaround that made all the double shifts worthwhile, Beth thought. The moment you finally understood what you'd been working on for so many months.
So that's what Operation Torch was,
she'd marvelled, hearing of Allied landings in Tunisia, Morocco and Algeria. And Dilly's women had all cheered because now they could look back at the October rush and realise what they'd done. Because they'd cracked the spy enigma, the German agents had been turned and forced to feed false information about where Operation Torch's convoys were headed. Because of ISK, Operation Torch had hit like a bolt from the blue, and Rommel in his desert headquarters was having a very, very bad time of it. Beth hadn't come back to the message about the Coventry raid for hours, and when she did, her duty had seemed quite clear. She'd just witnessed the importance of secrecy firsthand. Even the slightest leak outside park walls could have turned Operation Torch into a slaughter.
You can't tell Osla or Mab, she'd thought,
filing the Coventry message.
You swore an oath.
So when she bid them goodbye in the canteen later that morning, knowing they were off to catch the Coventry train, she'd done it with barely a hitch. What were the odds, after all, in a city well accustomed to bolting for air raid shelters at the first blare of a siren, that her friends would be hurt?
You were wrong,
Beth thought now, breath catching painfully. But it didn't matter. What was the point of telling now, when the damage was done? So she gulped a breath, took the secret, and mentally filed it away as she stood beside the frozen lake. She'd begun to find it quite easy, dividing life into compartments. There was the code and everything that came with it. And there was everything else. Her friends, her family, Harry, everyone, who had to come second. The code came first. When Coventry and all its losses were neatly boxed up, Beth waved to the hockey players and picked her way across the icy lake path, pausing midway as she saw a mass of Hut 8 cryptanalysts spilling across the lawn, cheering at the top of their lungs. Brilliant Joan Clark, whom Dilly wished he'd poached for his section, Rolf Nosquith, drinking directly out of a wine bottle, and Harry, veering away from the pack and picking Beth up, swinging her over the frosty grass.
We did it. We bloody did it. A pinch off U-559. We're back in. We're back in the bloody U-boat traffic.
Harry!
She kissed him jubilantly, every worry that had been consuming her falling away.
I knew you'd get in!
People were spilling out of huts and blocks, letting out cheers as the news spread. The U-boat blackout had gone on too long not to be common knowledge at BP, even if no one outside Hut 8 knew details.
Christ, Beth!
Harry was whispering into her hair, still holding on to her like a lifeline.
I wish I could tell you how we got in. I wish you'd been there.
You can't tell me anything. It's all right. I don't care.
He kissed her again, hands pulling through her hair, and Beth heard ripples from the people around them. It would be all over Bletchley Park in hours. Little Beth Finch and Harry Zarb, who had a wife and a child at home. She didn't care what people thought. It wasn't an important secret. Not like the one she just buried. 10 days until the royal wedding. November 10, 1947. Chapter 50.
inside the clock. Beth wasn't released from the straitjacket until after supper. Chafing her numbed hands, fighting the hangover of the injections, she wandered into the common room looking for a game of Go and her partner. But the board sat abandoned, the sharp-eyed woman nowhere in sight.
"Didn't you know?" another of the women said. "She was taken off this afternoon. Surgery."
Beth fought a swell of unease.
"What kind of surgery?"
Shrug. Beth sat behind the game board, fighting her disquiet. A matron came in with a list of tomorrow's visitations, but Beth ignored her. In 3.5 years, she'd only had one visitor. That was why it had taken so long to smuggle her coded letters out to Osla and Mab. So many dead ends, trying to sneak the cipher messages out with the asylum post, trying to bribe an orderly to post them off grounds, wheedling a fellow inmate into sealing a letter inside one of theirs. She'd been shut down or caught every time.
"Miss Liddell, no post in or out for you."
When she'd been sent here, MI5's instructions had clearly been strict. An inmate like Beth, with her head full of secret information, was not allowed to exchange news with the outside world. Only a few weeks ago had she finally been able to send her ciphered call for help.
"Visitor, Miss Liddell,"
the nurse had sung out, shocking Beth speechless. 3.5 years with not a single visitor from the outside world. Hurry, she'd thought, pulse ratcheting as she approached the visiting room.
"Bethan."
Her father stood in the middle of the room, which could have been her mother's parlour, except that all the knick-knacks were bolted down to stop hysterical inmates from hurling them at their visiting loved ones. Seeing her father's horror as he registered her chopped hair and gaunt face, Beth wouldn't have minded slinging a vase or two.
"Are you all right?"
he ventured, as the orderlies left them alone.
"Do I look all right?"
Beth had answered coldly.
"You look..."
He trailed away.
"Are you improving? I'd love to have you home again." "Why? Mother wouldn't."
"Of course she would. Well, not that she said... That is, she doesn't know I'm here."
An unnecessary statement, if there ever was one, Beth thought.
"She's visiting your aunt in Bournemouth, and I thought I'd
sneak out behind her back."
Beth's throat burned constantly from throwing up her pills twice a day. Looking at her father, it felt like she was choking out hot coals along with words.
"More than 3 years, Dad. Not one visit."
"Your mother didn't think... That is, we decided to give you time to heal."
His eyes darted across her smock, her chapped lips.
"They said it was a good place."
"Mother was only too happy to believe that, I'm sure. A place where I'm no longer underfoot, embarrassing her."
Beth choked herself off. She could rage at her father forever, but all that would do was drive him away.
"Don't waste this chance." "Thank you for coming," she said, making her voice gentler.
He relaxed then, telling family news, answering questions she kept innocuous. No, he didn't know what had happened to Boots. Beth choked down bitter disappointment, but kept nodding.
"I'd get you out if I could," her father had said at last, hesitant. "The Bletchley fellow said parental rights didn't have sway here. You're committed as an employee of the government, by order of the government, for your own good and for the sake of security."
"I know."
Perhaps the right person could make enough fuss to get her case reviewed, but her father didn't have it in him to kick down doors in London. He had barely summoned the nerve to visit her today behind his wife's back. Her contempt nearly choked her, but at the same time she wanted to cry, remembering how he'd let her help with his crossword when she was small. "Oh, Dad." Then she remembered how he'd stood by her entire life while her mother bullied her.
"Dad, I need you to do something for me."
"Bethan, I can't."
Her voice cracked across the room like a whip.
"You owe me."
And he'd walked out with 2 scribbled cipher messages in his pocket, promising to post them to Mab and Osla, wherever they might now be living.
He promised he'd do it,
Beth thought now, 2 weeks later, staring at an empty game board. He'd promised. But no one had come.
York.
Mab couldn't sleep.
Go to Clockwell or not?
It was near midnight when she slipped out of bed and tiptoed downstairs to sit in the dining room's big window. The table was stacked with damask napkins. Mab had brought them out to iron for her royal wedding listening party. There had been a certain amount of hilarity when her husband caught her practicing folding them into swans. "I used to decode Nazi battle orders," Mab thought, "and now I'm folding napkins into swans." The switch her life had made sometimes astounded her. She'd be going through the markets squeezing pears for ripeness or sharing a gossip with her neighbours, and it would hit her all over again. Just a few short years ago, she would have been surrounded by rackety machines, exhausted and oil-stained and pushed to her limit, but doing something that mattered. Now she had peace, prosperity, all the things she'd dreamed of during the war years. And sometimes it felt... Mab searched, but there wasn't a word. It wasn't that life now didn't matter. By God, it did. Being able to bring up your children in peace, praying the peace would last, was a gift she would never cease treasuring. Looking at the stack of napkins, she wondered if it was purpose she missed. Hands that folded damask swans yet yearned for war machines. She looked upward to where her husband slept, wondering if he ever felt a similar restlessness in turning his skills from war to peace. If he did, he never said so. These were things no one seemed to say. They all just put the war behind them and got on with it. "And is that such a bad thing?" Mab scolded herself. Perhaps life wasn't exactly exciting anymore. There were no great sweeps of passion or purpose to her days. But there was no grief or stress either. Adventure, excitement, passion, those things were unreliable. The Bletchley Park years had offered all that, love and change and friendships to outlast the world, or so it seemed. But all that had come crashing down, and Mab had built this new life over the ruins, stone by painful stone. Why on earth would she risk it all for a woman she hated? "But you may hate me," Beth had written, "but you took the same oath I did." And whether Beth was mad or conniving, she had risked a great deal to reach out past asylum walls for help. Mab scowled and made a decision. 4 years ago, October 1943. Chapter 51. From Bletchley Blethering's, October 1943. Bletchley Park is infested, not by mice, but by Yanks. Pestis Americanus can be identified by its unnaturally white teeth and Camel cigarettes. Mab shattered into pieces exactly 344 days after Lucy and Francis died. She worked out the figure in the sick room as she lay in bed staring at the ceiling. She'd been called to demonstrate the one remaining bomb machine in Hut 11A. All the others had been moved to outstations, along with the Wrens who serviced them. But demonstrations were still required from time to time, and a cluster of Americans was getting the show now. "This is how we set the bomb in motion," Mab said tonelessly over the machine's racket.
"Awfully finicky work,"
Lieutenant hovered, jostling. He had fair hair and an easy smile, and was probably just trying to be friendly, but Mab could hardly stand looking at him. She didn't want to be friendly. The only reason she'd returned to Bletchley Park was because it was work here or do service elsewhere. Because working here meant she could help stop the German bastards who had killed her family. And finally, because Frances would have been disappointed if she'd curled up in bed after the funerals and let the grief eat her alive. He'd have told her to carry on the fight. So Mab had come back to BP a shocking 2 days after Frances's funeral. She knew people had whispered, and she hadn't missed a shift since. She threw herself into her work, and why not? Frances and Lucy were dead, and that wasn't a false stop. She couldn't wire her life up like a bomb and get it running again. Everything had just stopped.
"Marvelous machines I've seen here," the Yank whittled on, oblivious. "And so many attractive ladies. As far as I can tell, the machines were made by the British Tabulating Machine Company, and the ladies by God."
He honked laughter. Mab looked at him. She didn't lower her eyebrows in her old scowl. She just gazed at him blankly until his smile dripped away. Mab didn't know what was in her gaze these days, but very few people seemed to want to meet it for long. She finished with the drums, changed up the wheel orders, checked the wires on the new wheels. Her lips were cracked and dry from the hut's airlessness. Mab reached for her pocket mirror and set it above the bomb's cables, pulling out her lipstick. She had a scraping of Elizabeth Arden Victory Red left in the tube. A sudden memory flashed of the time Lucy had rummaged in her cosmetics and used half a tube daubing her face in war paint. I shouted at her. Why did I do that? Mab's hand shook as she lifted the lipstick, steadying the mirror with her other hand, and an electric shock from the cables jolted through the metal mirror to her fingertips. She turned numbly, and the American let out a surprised shout, pointing at her throat. Mab raised her stinging fingers and touched something sticky, saw red on her fingertips. I'm dead, she thought calmly, looking in the mirror and seeing a red line across her windpipe. But it wasn't blood she smelled on her fingertips, just lipstick. The recoil of her electric shocked hand had jerked the lipstick across her own neck. It must have looked like she'd cut her own throat. I'm not dead, she tried to say, looking at the ash-pale Yanks. Instead, she found herself laughing at a high pitch, laughing and shaking beside the bomb machine, which kept on with its horrible, monotonous whirring. Mab tried to steady herself, but somehow slipped to her knees instead on the oily floor, still laughing, smearing and tearing at the red line on her throat. Then there were hands pulling her away from the bomb. Get her to the infirmary! When Mab pulled herself together, she was standing wan and swaying before a starchy-looking matron in a ward she'd never set foot in before.
What's the matter with you, then?
I don't know, Mab said, dazed.
What month is it?
The woman looked at her a moment.
October, love. 43.
10 months since she'd buried Francis and Lucy. 10 months. Soon it would be a year. Where had the days gone? Mab couldn't remember getting out of bed this morning or taking the transport bus here. She didn't know if she was on a day shift, evening shift, or night shift. She clutched for the blanketing cotton wool that had battened her senses for months, but it thinned and shredded, electrified away. Mab began to cry in huge, wrenching sobs. She hadn't cried since Coventry.
It's all right, love.
The matron steered her to a narrow white bed behind a screen.
You've got a touch of nervous exhaustion, I'll wager. 4 days bed rest.
My husband is dead, Mab managed to say. She wanted to add my daughter is dead, but she couldn't have anyone thinking that Lucy had been a bastard, and she couldn't say my sister after a lifetime of saying nothing else. So just, my husband is dead.
I haven't got a cure for that, love. I wish I did.
Giving Mab's shoulder a squeeze.
But plenty of sleep and water will still do you some good. Strip down and climb in.
Job's up, Mab whispered. Job's up, strip down. She peeled out of her black crepe, crawled between the sheets and slept like the dead for nearly 3 days. When she woke, she saw 2 male blurs at her bedside, one huge and dark, one skinny and ginger. The sight of any man who wasn't Francis sometimes hurt her, but Harry and Giles were so absolutely, comfortingly different in every way that she could look at them without flinching.
Sleeping Beauty awakes, Giles said. The Mad Hatters have been dropping in between shifts to see if we can catch you when you aren't snoring.
You snore.
Francis's voice.
But a very ladylike snore.
We brought the Mad Hatter's topper.
Giles was burbling, oblivious.
Thought it might be just the thing.
He plunked the outrageous object into her hands, and Mab stroked the spray of silk flowers, trying to remember when she'd last gone to a tea party. She couldn't even remember when she'd last read a book. I've gone a little mad, she thought unsteadily. Mad as the Mad Hatter. She didn't think it was over yet either. There were broken pieces jabbing everywhere inside, now that the cotton wool was gone.
You just missed Beth,
Harry was saying, linking his big hands between his knees.
She had to go on shift, and she's not really sure what to do around sick beds. You aren't a line of code, so she's stumped.
You and Beth? Mab wondered, looking at him. There was a thing a man's eyes did when he was in love, a softening at the very centres. She'd learned that from Francis. Abruptly, she wished Harry would go. She didn't want to look at a man in love when she'd lost her own. Mab remembered reading something rubbishy about the ennoblement of grief. What rot. Grief didn't make you noble. that made you selfish and hateful. She made herself smile at Harry, but she was glad when he left. Giles lingered, looking like a bony heron perched on his too low stool.
"You want to scream," he said, "don't you?"
"Yes."
Her hand left the Mad Hatter's topper and crept up to her throat, where the line of lipstick had looked like a knife slash.
"I wish it had been."
"What you need," Giles said, "is a transfer."
"Where?"
When the bombs were moved out and the Wrens with them, Mab had been stuck back in Hut 6, first on a Typex, more recently in the machine room, where she mechanically sorted and tested bomb menus.
"I'm not a brain like Beth or Harry. I don't speak German. No use pushing me in with women like... Osler."
The name stuck in her throat like a spike of ice. Perhaps she didn't loathe Osler with the visceral hatred that had gripped her after the funeral, but a tiny whisper inside remained uncompromising.
"If you hadn't let go of Lucy's hand..."
It wasn't fair. Mab knew it wasn't fair. She knew if she picked her anger apart, the feelings beneath would be far more complicated than simple hatred. But she didn't have the energy, and every day the gulf grew wider, so Mab simply kept to the road of avoiding her old friend. Hating Osler was less complicated, more comforting, and avoiding her was child's play. Keeping your distance from someone at BP was easy if you didn't work the same hut or shift schedule. Mab had moved from their shared room to a parlour cot, so even billeting under the same roof, she hardly ever crossed paths with Osler.
"There are all kinds of posts here," Giles continued. "You're not tied to Hut 6. Let's see if we can get you swapped into the mansion. Travis's team, maybe. I'll pull strings."
"Thank you," Mab managed.
He seemed to realize what an effort it took her.
"Things have been damned awful for you this year. I'm sorry."
Sorry. Everyone told her they were sorry. Why didn't they tell her how to go on living instead? How to keep going day after day, when soon it was going to be a year since she'd buried Lucy and Francis, then 2 years, then 3? Why did no one tell her how to keep living?
Chapter 52. From Bletchley Blethering's, November 1943. To the American officers who condescended to tell the ladies in Knox's section how to do their work, all BB can say is, "Really, gentlemen? Did you fail to notice these women have a CMG on their wall? You don't win the championship of the Order of St. Michael and St. George for best radishes in the Victory Garden."
"Loveliest of trees, the cherry now is hung with bloom about the bough," Dilly's voice echoed, happy and careless.
"But it's covered in snow," Beth answered aloud, looking at the tree arching overhead. Earlier this year, a warm winter had meant it blossomed unseasonably fast. She'd come to Corn's Wood with Abwehr traffic, alternating days with Peggy, and she and Dilly would spread a blanket in his garden and sit boxing and rodding as white petals drifted down. Now it was nearly winter. The cherry tree was bare. And Dilly Knox was dead. Beth stood alone under the tree, but not really alone. Turning her head, she could imagine Dilly beside her so vividly, smoking his pipe, no longer gaunt and greying, because in her imagination he was restored to health. When she came here, she could replay entire conversations they'd had before he died, tell him what had happened since, imagine his answers. Sometimes she pictured him sitting in the desk beside her at work, so she could ask his advice on a tricky crib.
"Gives me the creeps when you do that," Phyllida said, shivering. "It sounds proper mad, you having conversations with a dead man."
"It helps me work. Cope, too."
"The cherry covered in snow, that's the poem's third verse," Dilly went on in Beth's imagination. "You should read more poetry, my dear."
"When?" Beth asked the dead man. She tossed a stick for Boots, who ignored it as he trundled over the frozen ground. Her dog looked like a grumpy tin of Scottish shortbread in a little tartan coat Mab had made out of an old blanket. "Mab." But Beth pushed that familiar guilt away. "I've been trying to break back into the KK traffic, Dilly." A pinch during Operation Torch had produced a multi-turnover Abwehr machine, rewired and used for a link that hadn't been broken cryptographically before. "6 weeks of back traffic broken, but we haven't been able to get back in. Where's the time for poetry?"
This can be handy in our line of work. I've broken more than one key that was picked out of a line of Goethe. Operators are supposed to choose random letters, but they don't. It's not in human nature to be random.
He sounded affectionate at his universal failing.
So sometimes they pick fragments of poetry as keys instead.
Or dirty words, Beth replied.
I've decrypted a lot more traffic keyed to dirty words than lines of Schiller. Dear me, my well-bred gales are being subjected to Germanic cursing.
Scheiße, said Beth, and Dilly laughed until he choked.
How's that new cipher you're working on? She asked. Dilly had told her about it on her very last visit.
Tricky, tricky stuff. Reminds me of a rose, petals overlapping downward toward the core.
His hands had made vague blooming motions over the bed, a bed he was too weak to leave by then.
Travers didn't mind if I took it home to pick at. Not that I've made much headway.
Beth wished he were here to tell her more about it.
I miss you, she whispered aloud.
Nothing felt the same. Her billet mates were still avoiding each other, leaving Beth stranded in the middle, very determinedly not thinking about what had caused the breach, and if part of that might be her fault. Bletchley Park, with all the new blocks and new recruits, wasn't quite the haven it had once been. Beth felt waves of her old crippling shyness every time she stepped into the streaming mass of strangers at shift change. Yet things were going better now than they had during the old cottage days, Beth had to admit. With U-boat operations suspended in the Atlantic, American soldiers and supplies were flowing steadily. German and Italian troops were surrendering in North Africa. The massive invasion of Sicily had kicked down the door for the move to mainland Italy, and now the Allies were celebrating in Naples. An Allied return to French shores was being discussed in pubs and over tea tables as something that would happen, not something everyone hoped might happen. Things were better, but...
I miss my ladies, the imagined Dilly said wistfully.
Wherever he was now, Beth was sure he missed them.
I wish I'd been there when you took those Yanks down a peg.
Catching sight of your CMG set them straight.
It had been January when word came down that Dilly Knox, in recognition of his wartime achievements, was to be awarded the CMG. Dilly had been far too ill to travel to London for the ceremony, but he'd received the palace emissary at Cairns Wood, accepted the award, which he'd kept for all of 10 minutes before dispatching it by car to ISK with a note.
Awards of this sort depend entirely on the support of colleagues and associates. May I, before proceeding, refer them back? It is, I fear, incumbent upon me at the same time to bid farewell.
Everyone, Dilly's whole section, had wept. He died not long after. Beth realized she was crying, tears dripping off her chin. She collected Boots' lead and, without another word, trailed back toward the house. She didn't need to look back to see him sitting there in his university scarf, thinking of inward-folding ciphers and A.E. Houseman verse. Mrs. Knox came out of the kitchen, drying her hands on her apron.
Beth, could you take a stack of papers back to Bletchley for me? Commander Travis gave permission for Dilly to keep them in his library when he was working, but now...
Her voice trailed off. Her eyes were reddened, and Beth couldn't meet them straight on. Too much grief. Mrs. Knox rallied to complete the thought.
They should be back under proper security. I should have thought of it months ago, but no one came asking, and I've been in such a state. I can't think it was anything terribly important if they didn't send for it before now. But one still shouldn't leave these things lying about.
Of course I'll take them.
Beth followed her into the library, waiting as Dilly's small safe behind the wall panel was unlocked and a folder of messages extracted. Beth was tempted to peek, see if this was the cipher Dilly had compared to a rose, but tucked it unopened inside her coat. She'd ask if she could work on it in her spare time, if she had any. There was going to be another jumbo rush as soon as plans firmed up for the invasion, which would surely be this coming year. More work for Knox's section, feeding false information through double agents, then cracking the Abwehr traffic to make sure Berlin swallowed it. Beth telephoned the transport pool. She'd be early for her shift, but carrying a folder of Enigma meant getting a BP transport back to the park, and immediately. Drawing up to the park gates the better part of an hour later, Beth was surprised to see a familiar figure arguing with one of the guards.
Drop me here,
Beth told the driver and swung out.
Dad?
He turned round, red-faced, frustrated.
These fellows wouldn't let me in.
They won't let anyone in without a pass. She pulled him aside from the gate. What is it?
Your mother is in a state. The things she's been hearing about you.
The last time Beth had paid a dutiful call home, Mother had called her a tart and a serpent's tooth, and Beth had turned and walked right back out. She hadn't been privy to much family news after that.
What's she raging about now?
There is talk, Bethan, that you're mixed up with some dark fellow. The pastor's wife saw you in Cambridge walking with some chap she insisted was at least half black.
He's not black, Beth said.
Well, I'm glad to hear.
He's Maltese, Egyptian and Arabic. Shall I bring him round for tea?
Beth couldn't resist.
You're joking, surely. A heathen?
He was raised Church of England like his entire family.
Though Beth thought Harry's faith lay more in mathematics than God, they'd had some spirited theological discussions along those lines.
His name's Harry Zarb. He speaks Arabic as well as English. It's a lovely language. Oh, and he's married. But he's absolutely wonderful, Dad.
Bethan.
Plaintively.
Just come home.
No.
Beth spoke mildly but firmly, bringing boots to heel. I'm happy to visit if Mother can manage not to pitch a fit, but I'm never moving back.
I'm your father. I have the right.
No, you don't.
Beth looked him in the eye.
You didn't stop her throwing me out. You never defended me. You never told me I was clever, even though I can do the Sunday crossword 10 times faster than you. You never told me I was anything.
She thought of Dilly Knox, frail and bright burning, telling her she was the best of his fillies.
I have to go to work now.
Bethan,
don't call me that, she said without turning. It's not who I am anymore.
She made sure the folder of Dilly's work was properly registered, then took it to ISK, now moved over to one of the new blocks, when no one seemed sure where it should be filed.
What's this? Said Peggy as Beth opened the file. And what's that?
Looking at Boots.
That's a schnauzer. This is something Dilly was working on.
Why does ISK need a schnauzer? The Yanks already think we're potty because of Jumbo. Beth arranged her coat into a nest under her desk for Boots.
He'll be quiet as a mouse.
I couldn't go all the way back to my billet to drop him off, not when I was carrying those.
Do you recognise the cipher? Dilly was working on it.
It's an odd one.
Peggy frowned.
He told me he was working on Soviet ciphers.
But the Russians don't use Enigma machines, and this is definitely Enigma traffic.
That doesn't mean they haven't captured the odd machine or two from the Germans in the back and forth on the Eastern Front.
Peggy flipped through the stack.
Perhaps they're experimenting with a machine. Even if they are, why are we flagging it? The Russians are our allies. We aren't reading their post.
Goodness, whatever gave you that idea?
Peggy handed the folder back.
Put it in the stack of duds, and anyone with a free hour can have a crack at it.
Beth put it aside, reached for the day's Abwehr traffic, and immediately forgot about Dilly's Russian project. Later, she looked back at that moment, screaming in the ear of her past self.
Don't forget about that file. Pick it up right now, Beth Finch.
Pick it up.
Chapter 53. From Bletchley Blethering's, November 1943. Addressing the lovers who left a set of frilly knickers on the lakeshore after what one presumes was a tryst, for heaven's sake, fake a marriage certificate and go to a hotel.
Again, Mab coached Beth. My fiancé is an airman stationed in Kent, Beth recited, standing in the icy street before the narrow front of the gynecologist's office. All around them people pushed and hurried. He has 48 hours leave to get married before Christmas. I'm not looking to have children until after the war.
Say it's your fiancé who wants that, Mab corrected.
Most doctors would only fit married women for a contraceptive device. But given the war, some would fit affianced women. Mab had come here herself almost exactly 2 years ago, before her wedding.
Don't think about that.
If you say you're the one who doesn't want babies yet, you'll get a lecture.
Right.
Beth looked determined. She'd barely even blushed when Mab collared her, shortly after leaving sick bay, and said bluntly,
I know what you and Harry are up to. I think you're an idiot, but please tell me you're taking precautions.
Beth had mumbled something about using French letters, and Mab had sighed.
There are safer options.
Whoever would have guessed Shy Beth would end up part of BP's fast set, the ones who unabashedly worked off code-breaking stress in dark corners with any partner they could find. Though Beth didn't seem to be sneaking off to dark corners with anyone but Harry. Mab had Beth go through her story again, then pulled off her left glove.
You'd better borrow this. The doctor won't believe you without a ring.
It hurt, taking Francis's ruby off. Beth slipped it on, seeming to know what it cost Mab.
Thank you. I know you don't approve.
It's not my business, Mab said shortly. You want to get mixed up with a married man? Well, you already know what I think about that.
I'm not ashamed.
Beth's chin went up. And I'm not hurting anyone. Just yourself, if you think it's going to end in wedding bells.
I don't want wedding bells.
Beth really had to be the oddest duck Mab had ever befriended. And now she's about the only female friend I've got left. No Osla, no Renz. Most of the other women at BP didn't seem to know how to talk to Mab anymore. Those like herself who had lost husbands, fiancés, boyfriends, were so raw in their own grief that Mab avoided them. And the women who hadn't suffered such a loss either were awkward in the face of the pain Mab couldn't conceal, or flinched from her mourning black because they were afraid for their own loved ones. Whether they thought Mab was bad luck or bad company, they tended to avoid her now, all except Beth, who was looking up at the doors of the doctor's office.
Does it really work, this cap thing? Better than, you know?
She blushed. It works. Mab bit the words off. Lately she'd been having dreams about children, never girls. All little girls were Lucy, but boys. Baby boys with Francis's russet hair, boys of 10 with Francis's stocky build, running about with cricket bats. Boys so real she could almost reach out and touch them before they dissolved into the dream's mist. She'd wake up retching with longing. Beth disappeared into the office, and Mab went on to her own meeting in Trafalgar Square. Even on a cold winter's day it was thronged, lovers meeting under Nelson's column, children throwing crumbs to the pigeons.
Tell me about your husband, Mrs. Gray.
The journalist met her beside the great bronze lion on the south side of Nelson's column, as arranged. An exchange of names and pleasantries, and he was already pulling out his notepad. He's rather a well-known correspondent, Francis's publisher had said when he'd telephoned Mab. Doing a piece on Francis, perhaps you might answer a few questions when you're next in London. Mab would rather have chewed glass than rake over her memories for a stranger. But since she hadn't given Francis a russet-haired son for a legacy, she'd force herself to talk about his poetry.
What do you want to know, Mr.?
His name had already slipped her memory. She couldn't seem to keep anything fixed in her mind nowadays.
Graham. Ian Graham.
He had a beautiful baritone and public school vowels, a tall man, wire lean in rumpled overcoat and battered fedora.
I'm writing a series on the role of art in wartime. First a piece on Dame Myra Hess and the National Gallery lunchtime concerts.
What? My husband took me to one of those concerts. Mab huddled deeper into her black coat. Our second date. She'd spent the performance scrutinising the clothes of the women in the audience, while Francis sat transfixed by the music.
Such a marvellous thing, he'd said afterward. You know how these concerts came about. The art was taken out of the gallery for safekeeping. Then Dame Myra organised the most famous musicians in Britain to come play for the public, along all the empty picture frames, just so blacked-out London has something beautiful to listen to.
Marvellous, Mab had said, eyeing an ivy-print silk frock in the next row.
It won't be a puff piece, Mrs. Gray.
Ian Graham evidently took her silence for mistrust.
Francis Gray's poetry helped define trench warfare to an oblivious generation. In war, art is a balm.
Then ask what you'd like, Mab said brusquely.
More about you first. I understand you're billeted up in Buckinghamshire, doing war work.
Yes, office work. Too boring for words.
It really was, no fibbing required. Giles had got her a post filing and typing in the mansion. It was quiet and monotonous, and Mab thought she could do it forever.
Where in Buckinghamshire exactly?
The pencil jotted. A little town hardly more than a railway depot.
Really? You're not the first person I've met who does something terribly boring and vague up in Bucks, in a little town with nothing but a railway depot.
Is that so?
Yes. Most of the others were, how shall I put it, Whitehall sorts, Foreign Office sorts.
They'll talk about their own work readily enough, especially with a scotch or two down the hatch, but they all clammed when it came to anything about Buckinghamshire.
Mab gave him a blank look. I don't know what you're talking about.
Ian Graham grinned, a quick sunlight shaft of a smile.
Right,
he said and changed the subject. Routine questions, how long she and Francis had been married, where they had met.
Mab's nails bit into her palms as she made herself recount their dates, the hasty wedding.
Your husband enjoyed music. What about art? Paintings, sculpture?
I don't know.
Did he ever say anything about his war, Mrs. Gray?
No.
He took a rather well-known tour in 1919, collecting earth from battlefields for the families who hadn't been able to bury their boys. His letter about it was published in the Times. Did he...
He didn't tell me about that. Mab jerked.
Mr. Graham changed tack.
I don't mean to pry, Mrs. Gray. It's merely that you were Francis Gray's wife. His publishers and readers can tell me about the poetry, but you can tell me about the man. A personal anecdote, perhaps?
Personal? Suddenly Mab couldn't breathe. This wasn't like the hysteria that had gripped her during her bomb demonstration. This was rage and despair, two emotions flaming up in red and black. Turning, she seized the surprised journalist by the sleeve. I need a drink.
He bought her a gin at the nearest pub, not batting an eye as she slammed it back. The perfect place, dark and grimy, full of drinkers who didn't want to be bothered. No one glanced over as the choked words began pouring out of Mab.
You want a personal anecdote, Mr. Graham?
She took her second drink, turning to the journalist.
The truth is, I don't have any. Francis Gray was the best man I've ever known, and I was his wife less than 1 year. You know how many times we saw each other? 14. He was always travelling, and I had a job we agreed was important, so we did our best. We had a 48-hour wedding and honeymoon. We had 2 weekends in the Lake District. We had the odd meal in a railway cafe. We made love a total of 15 times.
She didn't care if she was being indecent. She didn't care she was saying it to a journalist. She had to say it to someone after thinking it for so many nights, or she would burst. Ian Graham listened without interrupting, and that was all that mattered.
We loved each other by proxy, Mr. Graham. He loved me through a girl he saw once in Paris in 1918, and I loved him through his letters, but we hardly spent any time together. I don't have any personal anecdotes about my husband. We didn't have time to create any.
Her voice cracked. She bolted half the gin.
I know he liked curry and dawn walks. I know he hated his own poetry and never slept the night through because of the things he saw in the trenches. But I didn't know him. You have to live with someone to know them. I've lived with my billet mates for 3.5 years. I know them inside and out. I loved Francis Gray, and to me he was perfect, and that's proof I didn't know him very well at all. I never got to realise all the ways he wasn't perfect. I didn't get to reach the point where the song he whistled while shaving drove me mad, or learn how rainy days made him short-tempered. He never got to realise that I'm not some great wartime love, just a shallow cow who lives for pretty shoes and library novels. We never got to quarrel over the milk bill, or whether to buy strawberry jam or marmalade. It was the thing that killed Mab every night. When she grieved Lucy, she grieved for the woman her daughter would never become, the young girl taking her exams, the cultish student heading off to university. But at least she had known the 6-year-old Lucy of November 1942 to her very bones. So much of Francis had still been an unmapped continent, a man she was only beginning to truly know. And he didn't know me, she thought, or he wouldn't have loved me the way he did. He would have realised I was a social climbing tart who would marry a good man like him as a ticket up the ladder. He would have realised he deserved better than me. I don't have one single photograph of the two of us together. Mab stared into her glass. Not one. We couldn't get a camera on our wedding day. It was short notice. And after that, we were too busy cramming in time together to pose for a flash. An entire marriage gone, without one picture to commemorate it.
She looked up at the journalist's grave face.
There's something titillating for your story, she said, mocking. Francis Gray's drunken Shoreditch widow, slopping gin all over you in a pub. I don't care if you print it. I don't care what you say about me.
I'm a journalist, not a monster, said Ian Graham.
But I do care what you say about Francis. Do justice to him. He was a good poet and a great man.
She finished her gin in a gulp.
Is there anything I can do to help?
The journalist asked, his voice quiet.
Mab turned sharply, nearly sliding off her stool. He caught her hand, steadying her, and Mab's skin prickled. Oh, God, how she missed Francis's hands. His fingers through hers, his palm on her waist. So much of her numbness had burned away in sickbay. At night, she now lay awake, holding herself in her own arms, trying to pretend they were Francis's arms, longing to be held again. "Stay with me," she started to say. The impulse went through her in a bolt of desperation. Take this man she didn't know up to some rented room and let him do anything he wanted, as long as she could keep her eyes shut and pretend he was Francis. Then she shoved that away, so sick with shame she almost vomited. Ian Graham got a glass of water and lemon from the barman and pushed it toward her.
"Drink that down."
He waited while she drank, then rose.
"I have what I need. May I take you to catch your train, Mrs. Gray?"
"I'm meeting a friend. We're returning to Buck's together." He hesitated, clearly not wanting to leave her alone, but Mab put out her hand. "Goodbye, Mr. Graham. I look forward to reading your piece." He tipped his hat and departed. She wondered where he'd be sent next, what blood-laced beach or bombed-out town he'd report on. Then she ordered another gin and thought only about Francis and Lucy. 3 drinks later, she was staggering. She nearly missed the doctor's office when she went back to find it, and Beth almost had to carry her home.
Chapter 54. Letter from Osler to her Café de Paris Good Samaritan. I wonder why I keep writing you in such a void, posting all these letters, 5 now, 6, into limbo, or at least to your landlady. It feels a bit like sealing a message in a bottle and hurling it out to sea. You never know who will read it, or if anyone will. Maybe it's better if no one ever does, the way I've talked my soul out. Happy Christmas, Mr. Cornwall, wherever you are. Ozma of Oz. Ozla was in a good mood for once when she sauntered through the ivy-hung doors of Claridge's. The last decrypt she'd translated on shift before running to catch her train was a radio message to a German destroyer off Norway. Please inform Oberleutnant W. Breisbach that his wife has been delivered of a son. Congratulations, Oberleutnant, Ozla thought, smiling. I hope you survive to see your son grow up. Surely at Christmas time it was allowable to wish an enemy well as a fellow human being. Ozla wanted Lieutenant Breisbach to raise his son in a world where that son wouldn't have to join the Hitler Youth, and assuredly that wasn't too much to hope for. It was the cusp of 1944. Surely now they could hope for the beginning of the end.
I understand felicitations are in order, Miss Kendall. The porter, Mr. Gibbs, greeted her. I heard your mother's happy news.
Stepfather number 4, what a rum thought. Is she home tonight?
I'm afraid not. The Windsor pantomime.
Osler sighed. I don't suppose you could rustle me up a suitable escort for her wedding next month, could you, Mr. Gibbs? Once upon a time, Osler would have brought Mab. Mab would have been a capital friend for a she-she London wedding, analysing every dress, making fun of every horrendous hat. But for an entire year now, she'd barely caught sight of Mab, except across the canteen. Osler's smile slipped as the memory rose of another wedding. Mab and Francis in this very hotel, looking so happy they stopped people in their tracks. I miss my friend.
Prince Philip will not be escorting you, Miss Kendall?
I don't think so. Philip had given up writing some time ago, after all. Trying to recover her holiday cheer, Osler bid Mr. Gibbs goodnight and swanned upstairs. If Mama wasn't here, at least Osler could stay the night in her suite and work up the next BB. Ever since Coventry, she'd been having trouble keeping BB's tone light. The jokes still came, but they came with more bite. Still, maybe that was all right. Humour could cut at the same time as it made people laugh. Maybe Osler Kendall would take a punt at becoming the next great satirist once the war was over. Oh, who was she fooling? If you were a man and you wrote funny pieces about daily life, they called it satire. If you were a woman and you wrote funny pieces about daily life, they called it fluff. Scowling now, Osler came out of the elevator, rounded the corner, and crashed straight into Philip.
Sorry. Oz, is that...
They stopped. My God, it's been so long, Osler thought, trying not to stare and also trying not to laugh. Philip loomed impossibly tall and tanned, more like a Viking than ever.
But he was also in a bathrobe and slippers, and no Viking ever looked at ease caught out in a bathrobe and slippers. He stuck his hands in his pockets, clearly mortified.
"You look well, Princess."
"I didn't know the Wallace was back."
"Yes, well, I'd be at the Mountbatten's, but they've a house full of Christmas guests."
They stared at each other some more. Philip didn't look entirely welcoming. His expression was closed off in a way Osler remembered from the few times she'd seen him angry. "You're right to be angry," she thought. "I ditched you, for very good reasons, but you don't know that." She couldn't say it, so she started chattering. "I've only popped in tonight to surprise my mother. Of course she's not home, and I think I passed up an outing to the cinema with the Glasbro twins too. I always wanted a twin sister, but given all the tandem giggling from those girls, I probably wouldn't have heard a word of the film." Osler ran out of breath. "How are you?"
"Getting over a touch of flu."
Now that she looked closer, she saw his face was flushed under his tan, and his forehead had a sheen of sweat.
"I was poking my head out for some handkerchiefs the bellboy left me."
Philip scooped the packet off the threshold, and Osler saw him sway.
"Steady on, sailor."
She put her hands to his shoulders, righting him, and his arms came reflexively around her waist. They both paused in the act of moving toward each other, and she could all but see him thinking, "I don't want to get you sick." Osler didn't care. She pulled his head down to hers, and they were kissing, pressed against the door. His mouth was hard and angry, but his hands at her back were soft, as if he couldn't stop from melting against her. He was warm with fever.
"You are ill," she said, breaking the kiss. "Not too ill to notice how good you smell."
It seemed to come out involuntarily, and he scowled, pulling back. Osler did too, realizing where they were. No hotel in London would allow a young woman upstairs with a young man, unless they'd presented a marriage certificate. But here they were, with a room at his back and no eyes to see.
"I'm supposed to be attending the royal pantomime at Windsor tonight," he muttered. "Aladdin, the princesses are acting."
"You're not going anywhere." Osler put a hand to his forehead. "Get inside." She pushed the door open, following on his heels. A modest room by Claridge's standards, nothing like her mother's suite. Philip's kit bag lay in a corner. The bed was masked as if he'd been tossing and turning.
"In bed," Osler ordered, kicking off her shoes. "I'm going to look after you."
"You're a lousy nurse, Princess."
"You're a terrible patient, sailor. Put that thermometer under your tongue."
"You're enjoying this,"
he accused, looking ready to bite it in half.
"Too bally right."
Osler hopped onto the foot of the bed, pulling his feet into her lap. He had long, bony toes, and she thought she could get quite inordinately foolish about them.
"It's just a chill."
"You're one of those fellows who say it's just a sprain when the bone is poking through the skin, aren't you?"
He looked offended.
"You don't know that."
"Yes, I do."
Philip stared at the ceiling, thermometer pointing skyward.
"I'd never had anyone look after me when I was sick before. Not really."
"Other than servants, you mean, or boarding school nurses with cold fish hands?"
Osler paused.
"I never have either."
She bounded off to get him a glass of water. "I'm enjoying this." Maybe it was the domesticity of it all, so ordinary and yet so strange. In her experience, getting involved with any man meant going places, driving, dancing, the cinema. The plain, everyday ordinariness of walking around barefoot in Philip's room, making herself at home.
"Down,"
she ordered, pushing him flat again as he tried to sit up.
"Bully,"
he said, spitting out the thermometer.
"Too right, darling, and it's working. Your temperature's down. You haven't been very good, but I suppose we can crack the fizz."
She'd had him order a bottle of champagne along with chicken broth. Fizz was good for invalids, everyone knew that.
"You've been in town a few days?"
she asked, popping the cork. He regarded her steadily.
"Are you going to ask why I didn't ring you?"
She topped up two tea mugs.
"I know why you didn't ring me."
An awkward silence. He struggled up on one elbow.
"Did you meet someone, Oz? Is that why you stopped writing?"
"No, I did not meet someone. Don't talk such slush."
"Then why'd you go off me?"
"I was protecting you."
"I thought maybe you were backing off," he said eventually, "letting things cool down. Can't say I liked it, but that would probably be the best thing."
"Why?"
Osler looked at him, but he only shrugged.
"I wasn't backing off. It's been a terrible year, Philip.
I saw my best friend's husband and little sister die in front of me in a bombing. She blames me, in part. Osler still blamed herself for letting go of Lucy's hand. So I lost her, too. And then every day at work I'd type up war reports, and the details could be horrifying. There, not too many lies in that mix. A few things omitted, like her fruitless, months-long hunt for files that were missing and then not missing. A thief or informant who might or might not have been real. Osler still wasn't sure. All she could do was keep her eyes open. So far, nothing else seemed to have disappeared. Anyway, she finished, I've been in such a blue funk, and I didn't want to write if I couldn't think of anything cheerful to say, and the longer the silence stretched, the harder it was to reach out. Osler touched his hand. Forgive me.
I've had a bad year too.
Quietly. Osler hesitated. Keep your distance. It's better for him that way. But she couldn't walk away from Philip like this, not feverish and alone in an impersonal hotel room at Christmas time. Besides, since she'd made the decision to back away from Philip, she'd seen Mab lose Francis, seen her rage and grieve that they hadn't had more time, more love, more everything. Osler stretched across the bed opposite Philip, twining her stockinged feet with his bony ones. Tell me. It came slowly, in terse fits and starts as they sipped their fizz. Across the Atlantic and back with a convoy, dive-bombed by Stukas all through the Mediterranean, when the Wallace was posted to assist in the invasion of Sicily.
There was one night in July, Philip said. The moon lit everything up bright as day. We were leaving a wake that glowed like the yellow brick road. The ship had already been hit. Everyone knew they were coming back to put us down for good. We had to come up with something quick. I don't know why the captain listened to my idea, but he did. We banged a big raft together out of crates and timber, heaped debris on it, slung a smoke float at each end, and cast it off. Then steamed as fast as we could in the other direction and cut the Wallace dead, engines, lights, and all. All of us sitting there in the dark, hoping the krauts would assume we'd gone down, and that raft of debris and smoke was all that was left.
I'll guess that they swallowed it, Osler said when he fell silent. Or you wouldn't be here.
They swallowed it all right. We had bombers screaming overhead, hitting the wreckage to send it to the bottom. Those bastards, strafing what they thought were sailors, clinging to debris.
But they weren't. It sounds to me like you saved your sailors, Lieutenant. Another shrug.
I swear I aged 5 years that night, Oz.
5 years? Osler turned over and he snugged her up into his chest, tugging the coverlet up over them both. Wasn't it only 5 years ago we met?
4.
That's all.
End of 39, at the bar downstairs. You in your boiler suit. You looked like Winston Churchill, but adorable.
My God, I was an absolute infant.
I was too. I thought war was going to be such a lark.
They lay quiet, feet entangled, curled up close in the dim room. To Osler, drifting off to sleep, it felt like home again. At some point in the night, she woke. Philip's warm chest wasn't against her back. Instead, she felt something soft and fluffy. Why did you wedge a pillow between us? She yawned.
I didn't have a sword, he mumbled, half asleep.
What?
A sword. It's an old story. A knight puts a sword in the bed if he has to sleep beside his lady, so she knows he won't cross over it.
What if she wants him to?
No answer.
Osler slid out of bed and began unhooking her grey wool dress. They hadn't drawn the blackout curtains. Moonlight threw a little silvery light into the dark room. She could see Philip sit up in bed. He must have got feverish in his sleep, because he tossed off his shirt and blankets and had the sheet drawn up around his raised knees. It was the first time she'd seen him without a shirt, and dear God, was it a sight.
Oz, he said drowsily as she peeled off her stockings, I'd better go sleep on the sofa.
You'll do no such thing, sailor. You've still got a touch of fever.
I'm not made of marble, you know.
He waved a hand at her satin slip.
There's only so much a pillow can do.
Well, I'm not sleeping in a wool dress, and I'm not sleeping on that blithering sofa either. She climbed back into bed on his side, hearing her own heart hammer.
You're a devil, he said through the dark, reaching for her.
His skin was still hot with fever, and Osler caught the flame, losing her breath, making him lose his as they tossed and rolled in the crisp sheets.
Hang on to me,
he said at one point, hands and lips sliding along the edge of her slip.
and did something Osler didn't have a name for, something she didn't know people did.
Only it left her wrung limp and breathless, hanging off his broad shoulders like she was about to fall off a cliff.
She could feel Philip's smile against her skin.
You're finally communicating, Princess.
Communication should go both ways, it seems to me, she managed to gasp, and figured out a few ways to do so, letting his hands and his strangled curses guide her along. They came to a stop, clinging and breathing hard, pressed full length, forehead rocking against forehead. A gentleman never pushed things past a certain point with a girl, unless there was some kind of understanding that things would soon be made permanent. Before, whenever they'd reached that point, Philip had never pushed further. But they'd never had an opportunity to be alone like this either, to do whatever they wanted. This time, Osler sensed, she could push past his protests. He was light-headed enough tonight to be reckless, if she was ruthless enough to push till he forgot himself. But he wouldn't have pushed if she were the one laid low with fever and forgetting herself.
Oz, Philip said, sounding strangled. Better put that pillow back.
Osler let her head drop, banging her forehead gently against his shoulder. I hate doing the honourable thing.
Oh, so do I, he growled.
They managed to rearrange themselves, limbs aligned back, more or less, where they should be, pillow wedged virtuously between, Osler's head on his shoulder. We could do this any time we wanted, you know, Osler said into the dark. Nothing's stopping us from being... more. It was the nearest she'd come to saying it, or even hinting it. Stop calling me princess because I'm not one, but I could be, if you wanted. But he'd already slid back into dreamland. They slept late, and by noon his fever was entirely gone, and he was sitting up in bed, demanding toast. They ordered from the hotel kitchens, ate in bed. Osler looked at the clock, sighing. An hour till I catch the train.
And I have no more excuses to skip the Christmas pantomime at Windsor.
She brushed a crumb off his lip.
Can't see you at a children's panto. It's more than that. The princesses do it every year for a private audience, to raise money for the men at the front.
He smiled.
Lilibet always gets stuck doing the men's parts, because Margaret has to get the princess role.
She already is a princess. Can't she play something else for one night?
You don't know Margaret.
Philip looked down at his plate, tearing the last piece of toast to bits.
Oz, you never really answered my question last night.
He looked up.
Why you stopped writing?
I said
a lot of vague stuff about it being a terrible year. That's not an answer.
His gaze was keen.
I know you. Terrible year or not, Osler Kendall keeps her chin up and goes right on fizzing along. So, what happened?
She couldn't look at him. You'll have to trust me, Philip.
Are you going to write when I ship out again? Or go out with me while I'm in town?
I'm not sure it's wise, Osler thought. This meeting had been accidental. If they started being seen around town again, she might be called on the carpet to face more questions. Turn over his letters, tell us if he contacts his family, tell us what he says over a pillow. And her oath meant she'd have to do it. Philip's face shuttered as she remained silent.
Thanks for playing nurse, Princess. Thought you ought to hear it from a friend, the voice on the telephone said.
David, what on earth are you blathering on about? It was the day before New Year's. Osler had been working up this week's BB with a razor-sharp lampoon of the Bletchley Park Dramatic Society's Christmas Review when her landlady had called her to the telephone. Osler had been puzzled to find Philip's chum, David Milford Haven, on the other end. I know Philip went to Windsor for Christmas after the pantomime. It was in the papers.
What's not in the papers is that he and Princess Elizabeth sparked like a bonfire. Charades with the family after Boxing Day dinner, dancing to the gramophone.
So? Philip and Lilibet have been pen pals forever. Charades, that's something you play with your little sister.
Not so little. She'll be 18 this April. Solemn, wants to join the ATS. Blue eyes, lovely legs. Philip got an eyeful of those when she was prancing around the panto stage in tights.
Do you have to slaver quite so audibly? Osler wrinkled her nose.
I'm serious, Oz. All through Christmas, our princess was looking at Philip like he was a god, and he wasn't exactly looking away. There'll be gossip soon. I thought you might want to hear it from me first.
Out of the goodness of your heart? That's just topping of you.
Fancy drinks at the 400, just you and me.
Osla rang off. She stood in the passage a moment, looking at her own legs, which were rather sturdy and wouldn't be much of a sight in tights. Princess Elizabeth, the future Queen of England, and Philip. He calls her Cousin Lilibet. He thinks she's a child.
Osla!
Beth's voice floated in from the front gate.
The bus! Coming!
Osla flashed out the door for work, where she tried all day not to think about princesses with big blue eyes.
Chapter 55. From Bletchley Blitherings, January 1944.
What is the worst toll taken by BP's necessary secret keeping? The worry of disclosing information while under anesthesia at the dentist? The pressure of lying to one's friends? No. According to the informal BP poll, it's having to bite one's tongue when Cousin Betty purrs yet again over the Christmas roast. At least my husband, brother, father is in uniform, unlike yours. Beth sat in one of the listening booths at Scapelli's, earphones clamped over her ears, chin on her folded arms. Harry wasn't coming today. He had a pack of six-year-olds coming over for Christopher's birthday, so he'd given Beth the music shop key for herself. Bach's parallel lines of melody were pouring into her ears now, precise and rippling, and behind closed eyelids Beth saw the new cipher, the cipher Dilly had been working on before he died. Who knew what the Soviets were sending over their captured Enigma machine, or why? Beth knew it was probably dummy messages, but the cipher itself fascinated her. It seemed to have been sent over a three-wheeled German army Enigma machine, but it was somehow different from the others she'd seen. Dilly was right about its spiraling inward. It seemed downright hostile to being wedged open. "Why waste time on that?" Peggy asked one slow night shortly after the year turned. "We've got stacks of more recent unsolvables if you're bored." As long as Beth had worked in Knox's section, there had been a basket heaped with the messages that couldn't be broken. You worked on the duds when you were at loose ends, but no one had much free time now with the Allied invasion of France looming. "Why waste time on Dilly's old stuff?" "Because it was his last work." On and off since bringing it from Corn's Wood, she'd turned back to it whenever she had a spare moment, working her way patiently through all the exercises she knew. Nothing to show for it, but being stalled didn't give her the colossal, mind-shattering frustration Harry had experienced with the U-boat blackout. Maybe because Dilly's discarded traffic hadn't been deemed critical, no one was dying in the cold waters of the Atlantic because Beth couldn't crack this cipher. It was merely a puzzle. She was starting to have dreams where a rose bloomed into lines of enigma that then folded up on themselves like a bud flowering in reverse. She was turning the record to the second side when the shop door banged open. Harry came in like a thunderstorm, hands balled into fists. She pulled her earphones all the way off.
"Is it Christopher? His party?"
Harry slammed the door so hard the frame rattled.
"I've been uninvited."
"What?"
"Christopher asked me not to be there. He says his friends will tease him because he's the only one whose father isn't in uniform."
"That little brat," Beth barely managed not to say.
She hoped Sheila had smacked him.
"Sheila gave him what for?" Harry said, as if reading her mind.
"Good," said Beth. "You should have stayed anyway."
"It's his birthday."
Harry began to pace.
He wasn't throwing a tantrum or trying to be cruel. Boys that age, the boys he goes to school with. They play war, they brag about whose father is off killing the most Nazis. Christopher's already a wog and a cripple."
He spat the words out with savage precision.
"Which puts him at the mercy of any bully who wants some fun. And on top of everything else, he doesn't even have a father he can be proud of."
"Yes, he does," Beth said.
"He has no idea what I do."
"Sheila doesn't know either, but she knows it's important."
"Christopher's six. All he knows is that the other boys torment him because his dad's a coward, and I can't protect him. And when he asks me why I'm not fighting, I don't have an answer."
Harry dropped into the chair opposite Beth, face bleak.
"The women working at BP, no one gives you dirty looks because you're not in uniform. Strangers don't stop you in the street and ask how you can hold up your head every day when other able-bodied young men are dying. Blokes don't give you a shove and say you don't belong in this country and you won't even fight for it."
"I'm only allowed this work because of the war on," Beth said. "And I still don't get paid what you're paid, Harry. Don't tell me I've got it easy."
"I'm not,"
he snapped, eyes flaring. She held his gaze, not backing down.
and he reached across the table, enveloping her hand in his bigger one.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't whine like this.
She studied him.
It's not just Christopher, is it?
Harry looked down at their hands, spreading her fingers like a fan.
If I'd known coming to Bletchley Park meant I could never fight, that none of us BP chaps would ever be allowed to enlist because they can't risk us being captured, I'm not sure I'd have come, and I'm not the only one who feels that way.
You wish you'd joined the RAF and died somewhere over Kent in 39? Beth asked, incredulous. Or been a gunner and got captured at Dunkirk? That would have been a better use of your brain.
Being clever shouldn't exempt me from danger. I'm not saying they aren't right to keep me from joining up now. The park's secrecy is more important. But I wish I could have had the chance to do more than I've done.
Are you saying you have no impact on this war? Estimate how many transports have crossed the ocean safely because you broke the U-boat traffic.
She paused.
Anyone can be fodder for machine guns, but only a few can break top-level ciphers. This war needs your skull intact. Let someone else get blown up. Better them than you.
You're not saying we're better than the boys who get blown up.
A lot of them, yes. You are. We are. Our souls aren't worth more to God, but our brains are worth more to Britain.
Harry looked at her a moment.
God knows I love you, Beth, he said, but sometimes I find it hard to like you.
What?
She felt like she'd been slapped.
Our brains work a certain way, a way that makes us useful, and yes, we save lives. But it is colossally goddamned arrogant to look down on those lives we save because their brains don't work like ours.
It's not arrogant to know what we're worth, Harry. And it's ridiculous to think that shooting our enemies is a nobler or more effective part of the fight than decrypting their battle plans. We might fight with paper and pencil, but that doesn't make it less of a fight.
I know that. I know the fight is worthwhile, but it's hollowed me out until I've wondered if I'll end up in a padded cell, and it's put a target on my son's back, and I'll be damned if I pretend I don't have regrets.
He pulled away, rising and beginning to pace again.
I wouldn't have you if not for this job, Beth said, feeling cold. Is that something else you regret?
Harry stopped. She saw the tension in his broad back.
No, he said quietly. But, Beth thought, I envy you sometimes.
Harry turned, leaning an elbow against the door jamb.
How you sail through every day, oblivious to everything but work. I can't decide if you really don't care, or you care but you're so focused it all ceases to exist as soon as you fall down the rabbit hole.
Care? About what?
The war, as it exists outside a stack of ciphers. Your friends, whom I know you love but you don't pay much attention to.
I do too.
Mab's drinking herself sick in the recreation hut after every shift. She's hanging by a thread. Haven't you bloody well noticed?
No.
Mab was unhappy, of course she was, but hanging by a thread. Mab, who still trimmed Beth's hair in its Veronica Lake wave every month, who had taken her to London for her contraceptive device.
I didn't realise, Beth said in a small voice.
And I just told you I love you and you didn't even blink.
He folded his arms across his chest.
Do you love me, Beth?
You also said you found it hard to like me, Beth rallied. That might have hit a little harder.
When you're clicking along like a clockwork mechanism, completely oblivious to everyone around you, yes, I find that hard to like. It doesn't mean I don't love you. I do, fairly incurably.
Beth looked down, fiddling with the earphones on the table, feeling one of her persimmon blushes sweep over her face.
I don't know what to say to that, she said finally, or what to do with it. We can't change anything. I don't want to change anything. So why do we have to discuss it?
Harry came over, tilted up her face and kissed her gently.
Beth, he said, you don't know what to do with it because it doesn't come in five-letter clusters.